Welcome back to the Royal Studies podcast. I'm absolutely thrilled to have with me today Lloyd Llewellyn Jones, who's professor in ancient history at Cardiff University. And we're going to be hearing all about Lloyd's new book, The Cleopatras, The Forgotten Queens of Egypt, which is coming out in May 2024. So hopefully by the time you're listening to this, the book will be out or just about, and you can pre-order your copy if it's not. So just to tell you a little bit about our guests. So Lloyd's research concentrates mainly on the Persian Empire, the ancient Near East, and the Hellenistic world. He works on gender and reception history as well. Lloyd's published extensively, and again, you may have already run into his copious works on monarchy and court society. Some of the recent books he's published include King and Court in Ancient Persia, The Hellenistic Court, and Persians, The Age of Great Kings, which came out in 2022. There's also, again, related to the current book, Cleopatra Thea and Cleopatra III, Sister Queens in the High Hellenistic Period, which also came out in 2022, and another book, Ancient Persia and the Book of Esther, Achaemenid Court Culture in the Hebrew Bible. So lots of fantastic work on royal women in the ancient and classical world. So today we're going to be focusing again on this new book, The Cleopatras, which I am so excited about. And I must say, and I've often said this before, Cleopatra was my gateway drug to queenship, Cleopatra the Seventh, that is. And so, you know, I owe her so much because as a child, reading about her got me fascinated in queens, got me fascinated in Egyptian history, got me fascinated in the ancient classical world, got me fascinated into history, full stop. So I have so much to thank her for. So when I heard this book was coming out, I nearly was like, oh, dancing off the wall, bouncing on the walls with excitement. So when we think about Cleopatra, I mean, obviously, we do normally think about Cleopatra the Seventh, the kind of infamous Cleopatra, if you like, thinking about her in the context of, you know, her relationships with Julius Caesar and Mark Antony. And maybe you think about, yeah, the Antony and Cleopatra Shakespeare play. I particularly think about Elizabeth Taylor. I mean, I can't help it. Again, as a young child, I saw that film and it is forever imprinted in my mind. I will forever be, you know, conjuring up her entry into Rome in that beautiful golden dress, etc. But this book is about all seven Cleopatras. So what encouraged you? I mean, so many people have written about Cleopatra the Seventh. What encouraged you to write about all of the Cleopatras in this way?
I think, Ellie, it's because of that kind of iconic image we have of Cleopatra the Seventh. Like you know, I became an ancient historian basically because I overdosed on Hollywood epics when I was, you know, a teenager. Rather than kicking a football around, I was watching, you know, Liz Taylor in gold lamé frocks. And this is an image that we've had of Cleopatra since her own death, you know, this kind of propaganda that she promoted about herself and then the Romans picked up, that she was a kind of lone wolf in many respects, a kind of unique individual, you know, and then therefore she's been championed by so many different groups of people in that way. So, you know, she's been championed as a vamp, you know, a sexually liberated woman. You know, very recently, of course, she's been championed by Black Lives Matter. So, you know, she's been claimed by so many groups of people. She's a gay icon through the Liz Taylor connection and all of this kind of stuff too. All of that is valid, and I would never want to take it away from her at all. But I think it was very important to get people to realize that she's not so very unique. Because in fact, she is one of a dynasty of women who actually prepared the way for her in many respects, and that a lot of her successes can be attributed to the fact that queenship had developed on a level unseen in the ancient world until that moment, where really this group of Ptolemaic women took power for themselves. It's almost like they took the patriarchy by the scruff of the neck, shook it up and said, no longer are we having this. And the way, therefore, they've been written about in the historiography, as you can imagine, has been incredibly derogatory. Because, of course, all good historians like pliant queens, okay? So, you know, childbearing women who support their husbands and therefore kind of disappear into the shadow of history. These Cleopatras were not that whatsoever. And so when historians have looked at them, they've always criticized them. They've called them things like Hyrcanian tigers, for instance, or despicable despots, or always with that kind of pejorative of woman overstepping rank and status, you know, and always something which is kind of dark, witch-like quality about them as well. And I just thought, enough is enough. Let's get rid of all of that and start looking at these Cleopatras with a clean slate to introduce them to the world. Within the context of what excellent work yourself and our colleagues have been doing on queenship, where do queens sit? Why are we fascinated by them? And then how can we analyze the world of Cleopatra the Seventh, the last Cleopatra, knowing this background that we have from her mother, grandmother, great grandmother, and so on?
Oh, that is fantastic. And I love that. I was kind of thinking of some of the adjectives and descriptions you're using. It almost sound like something out of horrible histories, really.
Completely and utterly. It really is. And to be fair, you know, I can't gloss over this one. There is a kind of macabre quality to the Cleopatras as well. Okay, they were surviving in a very dark world. The world of high politics in the Hellenistic period was a Game of Thrones kind of quality about it, I have to admit. In fact, you know, I think it leaves Game of Thrones standing because what went on within the Ptolemaic dynasty was pretty awful. It was a brutal time, and women needed to be brutal themselves to survive it.
Sounds like the Cleopatras would give Circe a run for their money,
I
so
think they certainly would. I think Cersei would kowtow to them. I think she would.
Well, this might be an impossible choice, but out of the seven, do you have a favorite? I mean, is there one that particularly stands out? And if so, kind of what is it that you really like about her?
You know, I like all of them for different reasons. Every one of them has her own story, and each story is quite unique to her. But within the whole seven, I do have a soft spot for Cleopatra the Fifth, Berenike the Third. You'll never have heard of her, I bet. She was on the Egyptian throne around about 80 BCE. She was the daughter of Ptolemy the Ninth, who was known to everybody as Chickpea, and his sister wife, Cleopatra the Fourth. And they th this marriage was actually a love match, which is really unusual in antiquity, and certainly amongst royalty, and especially amongst incestuous royalty. But this match was broken up by their mother, Cleopatra the Third, who was one of the most domineering women history has ever known. Think of Eleanor of Aquitaine and triple it, and that's Cleopatra. Yeah, and that's Cleopatra the Third. She broke them up because she had ambitions for both of her children in other ways, in terms of politics. And so, young Cleopatra the Fifth grew up really without knowing her mother at all. She's brought up at the court of Alexandria by her grandmother, this domineering Cleopatra the Third, and her father, who was kind of distant from her, really, as most pharaohs, kings were to their daughters at the time, of course. But she is used then as a kind of political pawn by her grandmother. When she's about 16 or 17, she was forced to marry her uncle, Ptolemy the Tenth, who was a particularly vicious character, not a good person at all, a drunk, brutally violent, you know, an oppressive tyrant of a monarch, really. But she was very able, and at this young age, she sat beside him on the throne, and it's quite clear that she made all the decisions because he really couldn't be bothered whatsoever. And after his death, she actually sat on Egypt's throne as the first female ruler in 1,000, 2,000 years. And this girl, she was 21 at the time, and she was a very competent ruler. She was much loved by her subjects, both Egyptians and Greeks. They looked out for her, they really adored her. And she leaves her mark, quite literally, on the history of Egypt, on the walls of Edfu Temple in the south of Egypt. There are remarkable, very beautiful 30-foot-high images of her on her own, offering new jars of ointment to the goddess Hathor. So she's quite remarkable. Now, she didn't stay an unmarried queen for very long because, of course, there's just no pattern for that whatsoever. And that's the difficulty, isn't it? You know, even she felt forced to conform in some way to the standard practice of having, you know, a dual monarchy on the Egyptian throne. You know, that's the way a yin yang kind of relationship was what was there in Egypt's theology. And so she did a kind of husband hunt. They needed to find somebody who was a close relative, of course, because this is the way that the Ptolemies operated. And it came in the form of a cousin, Ptolemy the 11th, he gets called. He had never known Egypt. He'd been born abroad. He'd been raised in Rome. And suddenly he appears in Egypt, not knowing the Egyptian customs, nothing of the Greek language, even. He was a bit of a buffoon. Cleopatra V hated him on sight. He hated her. And sadly, it was the shortest honeymoon we've ever had, of just 11 days before he murdered his bride. And then the Alexandrians rose up and killed him. They tore him apart, actually, limb from limb in the gymnasium at Alexandria, because they loved Cleopatra Berenike so much. So it's a short burst of brilliance, but I really like the woman. I there's something about her, you know, and she disappears under the shadow of Cleopatra the Seventh and all of this. But it's these kind of women I'm always fascinated by. I never go for the Anne Boleyns. I always go for the Jane Seymours. Do you know what I mean? I like the ones that kind of disappear under the parapet sometimes. And I think that we kind of, as historians of monarchy and especially of gender, we kind of have a duty to bring some of these women back into the limelight.
I 120% agree with you on that one. Absolutely. And I'm a big fan of those underdogs and the yeah. women who disappear but need to be brought back to the forefront yeah. as well. Absolutely. Well, that story was a very intense kind of example of where co-rulership goes horribly, horribly wrong.
Horribly wrong. Absolutely.
Violently wrong.
Yeah.
But as you were noting, I mean, obviously these women were co-ruling. They were co-ruling with, you know, their husbands who were often related to them, like you said, you know, brothers, uncles, cousins, etc. So these co-ruling traditions, this idea of, like you said, the dual monarchy, do you see that as more a reflection of, again, the ancient Egyptian traditions, or a Hellenistic kind of import, or a bit of a kind of merging of the two?
There's a little bit of both going on there. That's very perceptive of you, because I think the Ptolemies, as a Greek dynasty, a Macedonian dynasty or Greek speaking, they needed to find a way of articulating their power both to their Egyptian subjects and to their Greek speaking subjects. And in a way, the kind of royal incest suited them very well, because, of course, there was a mythological paradigm for this. So in Egyptian mythology, of course, Osiris marries his sister Isis and begets the next king, Horus. And so every pharaoh and each queen could play out that role. But equally within the Greek world, of course, Zeus married his sister Hera as well. So that sort of bilingualism appealed to them straight away. So I think they found, and they must have, you know, in the first generations as Ptolemy settled into Egypt and thought about the ideology of Egypt, they must have taken advice from the priests. For instance, to say, look, we've got a model here which really works. It's worked for us for millennia. Carry on with it. And I think the Ptolemies realized, you know, the old adage, if it ain't broken, don't try to fix it. And they kind of went with that. And in fact, they employ it far more than any ancient pharaonic house I'm aware of. So it became absolutely standard. By the time we get to the Cleopatras, that incest, royal incest, was the most important way of marrying alliances. And to be absolutely clear about this, this is not incest by name only. It is physical relationships that we are looking at here as well, because that blood was so important for them. So the next pharaoh should come from a brother-sister union. Mm. Sadly, Ellie, we don't have any osteoarchaeological remains. We don't have any bones or anything we can analyze, because it would just be wonderful to know, after, you know, six generations of inbreeding, what exactly was happening to the Ptolemies. We don't know. We know from the descriptions that we have from their enemies, the Romans, that they tended to run to obesity. But that's not necessarily, of course, a sign of the incest. But when we look at other later dynasties like the Habsburgs and so forth, we can see straight away the facial features and all of this kind of thing. You are forced to wonder what that inbreeding did to the Ptolemies. But they went with it because it's such an important statement about their divine royalty. When Sophocles wrote his play Oedipus, he calls it Oedipus the King, because he is a king and therefore he can do different things, like sleep with his mother and all this kind of stuff. And I think that really is sort of underplays what the Ptolemies are all about in this kind of incestuous context too.
No, that is so interesting. And it's funny because, it's something that I talk about with my students in my kind of queenship modules, this idea of kind of royal incest and how anthropologists have kind of studied it and as a particular kind of strategy. And we talk about kind of global monarchies where this goes on. And the students' reaction is always kind of
Oh,
like,
always, always.
aversion, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, does not compute, does not compute.
No, exactly. But it is a strategy and it is actually quite an effective one. And
It
it
can be
keeps,
very effective, absolutely. Yeah, definitely.
But like you said, the downside is the health, potential
Yeah,
health issues.
absolutely. But
So, yeah.
I think it's talking about global queenship, I think, and I know you're as interested in this as I am, it would be great actually to get a project about that kind of thing, about alternative family structures, really,
Yes.
to see what happens there and where these occur as well. Because I'm sure that there are experts out there that we don't know of yet, working on civilizations or societies that we have never touched. And it would be wonderful. We should do this sometime to get a call up for papers out and to really examine these trends, which we find so difficult to deal with. Other societies will perhaps find much easier to cope with.
Absolutely. And it is an integral part of many monarchies around the globe. So,
Yeah,
yeah, no,
absolutely.
I think you're absolutely right. And actually, I really like the way as well that you highlighted the divine kind of justification for it, or
Yeah.
that divine kind of side of it, because obviously, monarchy and the divine are always closely attached in some way, shape, or form. And obviously,
Precisely.
some of your Cleopatras were kind of goddess queens, etc.
Well,
So,
that's it, and really promoted themselves in that way. And also, to that extent as well, and I think you've discovered this in your work too, and certainly some of our colleagues, that queens don't operate like normal women very often anyway. Not only do they sometimes have this divine aspect, or at least touched by God or given the authority by God, but also they almost perform as honorary men anyway. Their bodies don't quite function in the same way in the ideology that's there, as long as they produce the heirs and so forth. And if they don't, well, there are ways of getting around that too. Elizabeth the First is a very good example of that, isn't it? How they function differently from nor women in normal societies, I suppose.
yeah, no, absolutely. So do you think that there, I mean, are there particular cults that really are particularly active around some of your Cleopatras? Do you think some of them are better at kind of projecting themselves as this kind of goddess queen, or is it more of a posthumous kind of thing? Like, is it more, yeah, I'm just
It
really curious about this.
begins in the dynasty as posthumous honors, and in
Okay.
fact, we can go right the way back to Ptolemy the Second, whose sister wife Arsinoe the Second is deified at her death. But by the time we get to our Cleopatras, which is 200 years later, we forget that the Ptolemies were on the throne for almost 400 years. It was a long dynasty. Halfway through that dynasty, the queens become deified in their own lifetime. And the queen that really capitalized on that the most was Cleopatra the Third, this difficult grandmother. She's quite a remarkable woman. She had been possibly raped or certainly impregnated by her uncle stepfather, Ptolemy the Eighth, a man whom history knows as Potbelly, a dreadful individual too, who had married her mother. And then he marries the daughter too. So at the same time, we have the mother and the daughter as co-wives on the throne. It doesn't make for a harmonious relationship, as you can imagine. So she goes to all of this. She survives this, and after her mother and her husband die, Cleopatra the Third really takes the reins of power. We see it in the relationship she has with the two of the sons that she promotes to the throne. She is the kingmaker. And in all of the representations of her, we see her standing in front of her son. That's not the way the Egyptians do it at all. Egyptian art is very hierarchical, but Cleopatra the Third stands in front of Ptolemy the Ninth or in front of Ptolemy the Tenth, always taking the position of honor. And she began to accrue for herself during a 30-year period in which she basically was the ultimate power in Egypt, more titles than any queen before her in the whole history of Egypt. She has titles invented for her almost on a monthly basis, you know, more and more and more. And some of these titles really increase her visibility as the as a living goddess. So one of the things she calls herself is the new Isis, for instance. You know, she is the Isis on earth. Not a representation. She is the living form of the goddess. And likewise, to her Greek subjects, she's promoting herself as the living Aphrodite as well. And also some of her titles are fascinating because she takes ancient Egyptian masculine titles, like the strong bull, and she uses them without putting any feminine endings on at all. So she actually claims masculine titles for herself as well. It's really quite remarkable. She establishes or has established for herself her own priesthood, and she has her own festivals in Alexandria where images of her are paraded through the streets, just as you would, you know, a figure of the goddess Isis. So she was remarkable for that. And I don't think that Cleopatra the VII, when her turn came to take the throne, I don't think she forgot that. I think Cleopatra the VII knew her family history, because we see her, Cleopatra the VII, using the same techniques as Cleopatra the III. So after this famous incident where Mark Antony performs this kind of elaborate ceremony in Alexandria, where he doles out the whole of the Roman eastern part of the empire to Cleopatra and to their offspring, she begins to call herself, first of all, Queen of Kings, and then she calls herself Thea Notera, the newest goddess. So, you know, newer even than her great-great-grandmother, you know. So I think she's very consciously drawing on some of these earlier precedents that particularly Cleopatra III created for herself. Quite remarkable.
Yeah, really interesting. And again, that's the benefit of bringing all the Cleopatras together. You can see how, you know, they're taking a page from each other's books.
Exactly. Yeah, precisely. And also probably by their mistakes as well, you know. it's kind of interesting, isn't it, that Cleopatra the VII was, in her father's will, was committed to marry her brother, her younger brother, Ptolemy the XIII. You know, that was the way. But she did everything in her power not to stay in that relationship, which is really interesting. And likewise, after she managed to get rid of Ptolemy the XIII during the wars with Julius Caesar, he died in that, she reluctantly, only reluctantly, married her youngest brother, 10-year-old at this point, Ptolemy the XIV, before she got rid of him as well. The only thing that mattered to Cleopatra the VII was her son, was Caesarion. That's what she was all about. Cleopatra's power base was never about her position as a queen on the throne herself. She never wanted that. She wanted Caesarion, her son, Ptolemy the XV, to be recognized as the pharaoh. And there we see another aspect that we have of queenship in operation too, this desire to place, you know, a son on the throne, which, you know, flies in the face, therefore, of Cleopatra the Third, who did anything other than keep their sons on the throne. You know, so there are patterns in reverse that go on as well.
Yeah. No, that is really, really interesting. So I guess just to kind of bring this all together, I'm very aware of the fantastic work you've done on other monarchies, on other, you know, Hellenistic monarchies, but also the Persians and things as well. So when you're looking at this group of royal women, how do you think they compare with the women you studied in Persia or the women that you studied in other Hellenistic dynasties? Are they really unique and different? Or can you see, again, those patterns there that kind of resonate with other examples?
They are not so very unique in a Hellenistic context, because this in a way was a kind of golden age for queenship. So the Seleucids in Syria, for instance, had something similar going on for women. And in fact, in the age of the Cleopatras, many of the Seleucid queens were Ptolemaic. In fact, you know, the daughters of Cleopatra III all married Seleucid kings. And so they take Ptolemaic ideas of queenship with them, and they changed the face of Seleucid rule quite considerably. Amongst the Macedonians, there had been quite a strong tradition of powerful queens, you know, at the beginning of the Hellenistic period anyway. But what is different about is that these queens, and I think it's because of the Egyptian system, have a considerable political and religious role to play. And we find that, in the pharaonic period, the queen, the Hemetnesuwera, the great royal wife, had a status, beyond anything that I find in, say, Assyria or Babylonia or Persia. I think the queens in these other societies beyond Egypt had to play a game in the shadows. They have no official roles whatsoever. They are never really even addressed as queens, as the concept that we have kind of created in this way. At best, they are the wife of the king or the mother of the king and can only operate in those ways. That doesn't mean to say that they lack agency at all, but there's often no official role for them to play at all. Egypt had all of that made, and this is why the Cleopatras could capitalize on it so extremely well. But in the other ancient societies I've looked at, in ancient Israel, Persia in particular, queenship is not an official area, really. Women just need to be opportunistic, and have agency in different ways, which of course we see in so many other cultures, post-antiquity as well, of course.
Oh, fantastic. Well, that's really, really helpful, like I said, to put these women in the kind of broader context and to see how very special they were. So, I know that the listeners here, hopefully they've this has whetted their appetite for the Cleopatras, but
Oh,
it's
I
going to
hope
be absolutely fantastic. So, yeah, I'm super excited. I can't wait to read
so.
it.
Thanks,
So,
Emily.
thank you so much for taking the time and
Oh,
coming
you're very
to tell us
welcome.
about
Really
them,
great. Happy to
particularly
see you.
Cleopatra the Third. I've got to find out more about this matriarch.
Ah, she's
She's
amazing. She's
fascinating.
amazing. Absolutely. You're
Oh, thank you so much, Lloyd, for coming
welcome.
on the podcast and speaking to us about your new book, The Cleopatras, Forgotten Queens of Egypt, again coming out with Wildfire Basic Books in May 2024.